from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to the Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out how the Modus Dance Company pairs dance with wine and food.
I'll get a preview of two art exhibits, two that take a look back at Mass Ave and its art scene in the 1980s.
Speaking of art, I'll talk with Kurt Churchman about his new Gallery 2 in Broad Ripple. Plus, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Fine wine paired with delicious appetizers while dancers interpret these food and beverage courses? Well, that's the yummy premise behind Modus Dance's upcoming event called Pairings. Sharon Gamble asked Modus Executive Director Heidi Keller Phillips to tell us more about this June 14th event at the White Rabbit Cabaret in Fountain Square.
Something I've always wondered, and I've never had the chance to ask, so I have you captive in front of a microphone. Tell me about the name of Modus Dance.
Modus is a Latin word for motion.
Oh!
It is that simple. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. Katie Casper was our founder, and she really has a love for those Latin bases. And so, yeah, the first several shows that we put on all had Latin names as well.
Oh, I get it. I get it. That's hard to keep up for. Is it 10, 11 years now? Is that
it's
possible?
Been 10 years. It'll be 11 coming this November when we put on our third Cultivate, which is the choreographer's concert that we put on in the fall.
Great.
Yeah.
And so what distinguishes Modus Dance?
I would say we are distinguished by our passion for dance. We are all people who believe in finding your expression, your creativity. We want to be a home for that. We want to be people who collaborate with one another and push the boundaries of a classic art form. So we're bringing dance out of the traditional spaces as well as being in traditional theater spaces. And we're taking a modern dance form that's now become pretty classical. And we're pushing that a little bit out of those boxes that they've become defined as, and just expressing ourselves and hoping that other people will have the opportunity to express themselves as well. It's all about joy.
And you are really ambitious as far as outreach and teaching. I was looking at your calendar recently,
yes,
and it's like, wow, there is so much.
We have a lot going on, but we do have a lot of artists who are involved, and they all have different passions. So, you know, we put together this teen intensive because we have a lot of our artists are out in the field teaching the young people. And even though we've distinguished ourselves as being for adults, real dance class for adults, and dance-inspired fitness classes as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're bringing people's dance mojo back, you know? We still do the teen intensive so that we can give teens who are finding their joy and finding their path in life a real professional experience and broaden their horizons and expand their vocabulary so they can move forward and do the same thing.
If there are teens or maybe relatives of teens, friends of teens listening, do the teens for the summer intensive need to be a certain, I mean, what's the lowest age, and do they have to have some experience, or can they come in just being intrigued by dance?
It is not for beginners.
Got it.
It is for people with some experience. I think we say at least 2 years.
Makes great sense.
And our target range is 13 to 19, but if you have someone who is 11 and dancing like she's been dancing for 10 years, then obviously we'll make an exception.
Sure.
It's just a one-weekend workshop, and it expands the traditional studio techniques further. So more modern, more improv, more professional experiences beyond what you would get in a Classic Theater, or sure. Classic Studio.
And I love that in that one weekend on July 26th and 27th, you're fitting in improvisation, jazz, hip-hop, as well as more traditional techniques.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of hit it all.
And is it when you discover who you have, when you, you know, kind of look at the teens and see what their skill sets are, is it customized a little bit based on who's in
it? Will be customized, yeah. Absolutely. And our teachers are pretty fantastic at giving each student what they need, even within a class. So if you have someone who's working on some techniques that are a little more basic, you can modify a class toward them, as well as giving a challenge to the ones that might be more advanced.
Yeah, you say that, you articulated that pretty easily, but that's a tough skill set, no matter what subject you're teaching, to be able to embrace the whole room that way.
It's not really that tough when you come down to the physicality of it. The tough part is making everyone feel comfortable.
Right.
Because there can be a little bit of a competition feeling, a competitive setting. We try to get rid of that as much as we possibly can. We don't say anything about body types. We are totally inclusive. We think everyone should be able to dance.
And, you know, boy, that's especially true with kids, with teens, because mm-hmm. they, although if they've been in dance a couple of years or more, they probably are not so much this way. But, you know, kids tend to stay in their own universes. You know, I'm a Broad Ripple student, and I kind of hang with all my Broad Ripple friends. And and I'm going to be competitive if you put me out there with kids,
yes.
I don't know.
Yes. And it's okay to belong to a group and feel like you're comfortable in that. But it's pretty cool to come outside of that and realize who you are as an individual and how you can give to a class and give to a workshop and make it what it is. And take you always take what you put in. Always.
There's stay tuned, listeners. We're gonna if you haven't already hopped onto your smartphone and looked up MODIS's website, we'll remind you of how to get there. There's a scholarship application form for the Teen Summer Intensive.
Yes,
there as well.
And there's a Power to Give, what do you call it?
Portal
campaign.
Yeah.
At the moment, in order to provide those scholarships, so we would love the support if you have the ability.
Great. Hey, speaking of fundraising, so let's talk about something that's even more intimate, which is MODIS Pairings, which you've been doing for a few years now, right?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I don't even know what year this is. Maybe sixth, seventh? I've lost count.
The fun all blends together.
Yes, exactly. This is a very, very fun event.
So people have a chance to drink some fine wines paired with some food, and you have some pretty spectacular people involved in choosing that wine and food, right?
Yes, we do. Adam Ditter and Noah Miles from Bluebeard are our chefs, and Bluebeard is providing some of the food sponsorships as well as Amelia's. And our courses are amazing.
Have they given you any sneak preview, told you what?
Oh, yes. We have a tasting with the chefs. The choreographers and the chefs get together in, I think it was late February this year, and we have our special creative meeting, and we get to taste everything and decide what goes with what. And then we start talking about how this is going to become a dance.
So let's start with the food, and then I want to hear the process of how you extrapolate the dance from the food. What's your favorite item that's going to be on the menu?
My favorite? It's so hard to choose. There's
two
so
or
many
three
good
favorites.
I have three. That have been brought to us by very special sponsors. And the first course I'm going to tell you about is a spinach melt flatbread with tomato jam, Gruyere, and pickled red onion.
Ooh.
We paired it with a Sauvignon Blanc, and the wines are coming from Republic National and Ed Gable this year. And when we tasted it, it tasted like a deconstructed pizza. There was a spiciness to it, and we started talking about the Italian countryside and a porch and a vineyard. And then it came up rocking chair, and then Indy Reed's books came on to sponsor this course. So Jenny Thomas, our choreographer, took rocking chairs and books and this Italian countryside feel and created this amazing piece.
I want to go there right now.
I know, right? And the next one I have is a hanger steak with green beans, yellow squash, and duck sel. And it's paired with a cab sav. And we kept talking about how complete it was, and it was slow-paced and very full. And Stephanie Squint took this course and made it into a duet that was kind of minimal, but sassy and saucy and sultry.
Mm.
And the sponsor for that one is Indie Dance Academy, and that's going to be a wonderful piece as well. And my third course is a dessert course. And this one's especially interesting. It has a sweet corn ice cream with jalapeno jelly on a cornbread cracker with candied bacon.
Oh, my goodness. There's nothing about that I don't like.
I know, right? And it's such a fun combination. We paired it with a Chardonnay. And the descriptions were, when we tasted it, smooth and spicy, icy, butteral, crispy and crunchy. So Rachel Higgins took this on and made a spicy spitfire of a solo, kind of evoking the power of a woman scorned chasing the last chances of sweet summer romance.
Ooh.
And that one's brought to you by Pivot Marketing. So
wow.
We're so excited to have all our sponsors on.
How fun. Tell us about the music that...
That is choreographer choice.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have that in front of me, but I can tell you, all of our choreographers make really interesting, beautiful, unique choices.
Sure.
With their movement and their music.
And unexpected, just based on past performances I've
Absolutely.
Seen.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There might be something that you're not familiar with because it comes from world music or hip hop or something that you don't necessarily get to hear all the time.
And then there might be Elvis. And there will be, because there's another dessert that has peanut butter and bananas in it, and we totally went all of us on that one.
Oh, okay. So I have to ask, young, skinny, sexy Elvis, or the Elvis that people who hear us who are old enough to remember his last performance at Market Square Arena?
Elvis won't actually make an appearance.
Well, I know, but I mean, as interpreted through.
It was interpreted more of a, because of the peanut butter and bananas thing, we kind of went in a housewife direction.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a freedom that happens in the middle of it where they kind of throw stuff away. But yeah, there's like a prim and proper housewife to begin with the peanut butter and banana thing going on. But it's really interesting. It has a espresso, mocha whipped cream, I think. I don't have that one in front of me,
man.
But it's amazing. It's amazing. You need to taste this.
It's a good thing you all are up on stage dancing because, you know.
Work
and
it
I
off.
Know you're not eating that night. You can't
work
eat
off
until
the calories.
After.
I can eat. I'm hosting.
Yeah, there you go. So as the executive director, tell me what the biggest challenges are for you.
Right now, I can tell you without a doubt, it's space. And with that goes hand-in-hand fundraising and
sure.
funding. Our space, while we are so thankful to have been there for 6-7 years now, the building is falling down around us. We have water coming in. And the owner really cannot afford to keep it up any longer. He doesn't live here. It's been for sale for a long time. So we are looking for a new space. We need studio space, and we're not the only ones. There are other organizations, performing arts organizations, who also are in need. And I will sit on committees, and I will do whatever I can to make this problem go away and to come together and collaborate on a solution for this. I think there could be a dance complex in Indianapolis. I think that would support the art here. I think it would be amazing. And you have to realize that dance is kind of on the bottom of the totem pole of arts. I would say music is probably at the top, and they get the most support, and they don't ever perform without getting paid. Dancers perform without getting paid all the time. We are always giving and giving and giving, and I feel like we need to support the bottom in order to grow this art totem pole in our city and make it flourish.
Sharon Gamble with Modus Dance's Executive Director Heidi Keller Phillips. Heidi mentioned after we turned our microphones off that Kinney Danceware and The Good Earth have also been key partners in pairings. Pairing starts at 7 p.m. on Saturday, June 14th at White Rabbit Cabaret. That's 1116 Prospect Street in Fountain Square. Get your tickets and learn more about the Teen Summer Intensive at modusdance.com. That's M-O-T-U-S-dance.com, modusdance.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. In 1984, Mass Ave began its transformation from a spot few people wanted to go to the place where everyone wanted to be. Two new exhibits at two of the city's major institutions, both opening June 27th, take a look back at that time. 431 Gallery Art and Impact at the Indiana State Museum, and Ed Sanders' Life and Art at the Heron School of Art and Design. Travis DiNicola spoke with curators Mark Rushman and Brett Waller about the two shows.
Mark, Brett, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Good to be here.
I've been very excited about this interview for a while, ever since I heard about the two shows that you've both been working on. I have to say that, I moved to Indianapolis in 96, and it seemed like when I got here, all the people that I met in the arts community, you know, and I ask, like, well, how'd you guys meet? Oh, we met through 431. I'm like, what's 431? Or I meet an artist, like, oh, yeah, I remember the days of 431. They'd sort of say wistfully, and there was all this talk about this 431 space, and now I'm finally going to be able to see what it was actually like, right? I mean, that's kind of the idea behind this, Mark.
Yeah, we're going to take you back. We're going to take you back a few years from 1984 is when it actually opened.
Mm-hmm.
It was started by former Heron students. Bill Atkins was the original president. He was a founder of it, along with his fellow classmates. And it remained in business through 1993. So it had a good 9-year run, which in and of itself is quite remarkable for a cooperative gallery.
Mm-hmm. Well, what made it so special? I mean, you know, people do talk about it as if it was, you know, a real turning point in Indianapolis sort of art, you know, history in a way. I mean, Mass Ave at that time was really a lot of, strip clubs and loan shops and, you know, a few bars and not a whole lot else, right?
It was pretty run down. I was just down the street at 421,
mm-hmm.
and 431 opened we opened up just about the same time. And so I had kind of a bird's eye view of what was going on. And what really separated the gallery from the rest of us, we were commercial galleries. We were in the business of selling art,
mm-hmm.
Making a living out of it, and promoting our artists. And the 431, it being a co-op gallery, it was more about experimentation, taking chances, showing works that maybe most of the commercial galleries weren't going to show. So their emphasis wasn't so much on sales as much as giving their artists exposure and providing a venue to see cutting-edge work.
Okay. Now, Brett, let me ask you about this, because you came to become the director of the IMA in 1990.
Right.
So there was a little bit of an overlap. But how aware were you at that time of what was sort of going on Mass Ave, or were you really even able to be?
Well, yes, I was impressed. What I didn't appreciate was how recent the redevelopment of Mass Avenue had been, because when mm-hmm. I came, it was booming. You'd go down, the streets were full of people going to openings for First Fridays and Rushman's Gallery down the street. My wife is an artist, and we exhibited with Mark for a number of years until the mm-hmm. gallery closed. And so I appreciated it, but I didn't really grasp what had happened, mm-hmm. the transformation that had come about, or the people involved. I knew of Ed Sanders, for example. I'd seen mm-hmm. his work.
But sure.
I didn't know him. He was not easy to engage.
No.
And I think
mm-hmm.
we never had a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But when I finally had a chance to see a body of his work after his death, mm-hmm. I was blown away.
It's really amazing work. And you mentioned Ed. I mean, Ed was a big part of the 431 gallery, I know, and was an artist, also an architect, who was very much a part of that scene for a long time. I also, you know, crossed paths with him, but never also, you know, really spoke to him much, was familiar with his work. I always found his work very fascinating, very kind of dark and interesting. Mm-hmm. Always remind me a little bit of like Francis Bacon somewhat.
Bacon admired Bacon greatly, obviously.
Yep. Yeah, it was very clear in his work. This is a really interesting thing to have these two exhibits at these two institutions happening at the same time. One being the look back at the 431 that's at the State Museum. The other one being the Ed Sanders exhibit at Heron. How did this come together? How did you two decide to have these two exhibits at the same time and make this connection? Because it's pretty extraordinary for the two organizations to be working together. I mean, I know you two have worked together, but,
right. Well, Sanders died in 2006
mm-hmm.
at the age of 59, way too early. And a couple of years later, Steve Mannheimer, who was a Heron professor and a critic for the Star, called me, and I got to know Steve, and said, I'm going to go down and see a body of Ed Sanders' work that his nephews have. You want to go along? I said, oh, why not? And I think Steve Paddock was with us, and we drove down to the south side of town and into a place, one of the rental storage locker places, and spent several hours looking at things being pulled out and just astonishing works that I had never seen. I had no idea of the range of his work and the fact that because the works were so big and bold and aggressive and dark and heavy and wouldn't hang neatly over a sofa in the living room,
no.
He didn't sell a lot.
Yeah.
He also was not a good schmoozer. Those things taken together, with a body of some 200 works over a period of his career of 25 years or so that were basically in storage. And coming back, we said, gee, there ought to be an exhibition. And then I was talking with Mark about this, about, well, you know, where could we do such an exhibition? Where could such an exhibition take place? At that point, I had retired as director of the IMA, and Mark hadn't yet started at the State Museum.
Yeah, this was before I was at the museum. Just closed Rushman Gallery.
Yeah.
And Brett brought it to my attention, and excuse me, and in turn, I brought it to Rachel Perry's attention at the State Museum.
Mm-hmm.
We pitched the idea there, and they were interested, but it didn't really move any further along.
Sure.
And it wasn't until I came along taking Rachel's place as the current fine arts curator that we dusted the plan off and we moved it forward. So that's how we got to where we are now.
And the plan at the beginning was both a show of Ed Sanders' work and the 431 Gallery, which we thought might both take place at the State Museum.
But then when that plan did move forward, we recognized the opportunity to partner with Heron School of Art, and it made perfect sense. Sanders was a graduate of Heron. The times for the shows were lining up, and the partnership formed from
there.
And
the two buildings are just a block across from each other pretty much, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's going to be a wonderful evening, a wonderful opening reception, and two wonderful shows for the public to see.
That's very cool. I mean, it's great to have these two shows and sort of look at two different aspects of this. One thing I'm very curious about with the 431 show, Mark, at the State Museum is you guys are actually kind of recreating that space within the State Museum, right?
We're going to we're going to build the 431 gallery within the Nisors Gallery. And the whole idea behind that is to give people a sense of what the space was actually like.
Mm-hmm.
The 431 Gallery was a fairly small, intimate space. And whether you're doing a one-person or a group exhibition in there, you only have so much room to move around and see the work. And I felt like the experience of walking into the space and, in a sense, reliving what an opening reception would have been like in the gallery would be the best way to show the work.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to build a facsimile of the gallery, as I said, in Nisors, and then we'll hang a group show inside that structure, and then the rest of the artists will be represented throughout the rest of the gallery.
You know, and to give some context here, 431 Mass Ave is basically it's a clothing store now, right?
Two clothing stores.
It's right next to the Chatterbox,
mm-hmm.
and so you've got two clothing stores in there, in that space, so a little bit different. Things have changed a little bit on the avenue as well.
Quite a bit.
One thing that I also think is very important that that you're doing with this. The different public discussions that are taking place at at the State Museum, at Heron, and involving a lot of people who have been involved in the past. Brett, you mentioned Steve Mannheimer, who used to be the art critic of the Star and Heron professor, as well as other people involved with this conversation, everyone from David Anderchik from the Chatterbox, Carolyn Ard. You've also got Dave Lawrence from the Arts Council is going to be part of one of the discussions, Joyce Summers from the Arts Center, a lot of different people who've
been a part. David Hoppe from
Nouveau.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that's a really cool thing, too. What is this sort of like a look back, or what are these discussions going to involve?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the opening reception is on the 27th, Friday mm-hmm. night. The following day, on the 28th, we're going to have two panel discussions. Mm-hmm. The first one is going to be from 10 until noon at the Indiana State Museum. And there we're going to focus on the 431 Gallery, talking
okay.
about what it was all about, its impact, and just trying to get our handle on its overall effect on the Indianapolis landscape. The afternoon session is going to be over at Heron School of Art, and that's going to be moderated by David Hoppe. And there it's titled Our Journey, 30 Years of Art. And really we're going to take a look back at the past 30 years of art in mm-hmm. Indianapolis and the surrounding area. And, you know, so much has happened since 1984. But I'm not so sure that we've actually taken the time to look at it and figure out where we've been and where we've come and maybe get some idea of where we're going to go in the future. So I think both of these panel discussions gives us an opportunity to, you know, reconnect with our past and also look forward.
So, again, the panel discussion about 431 Gallery taking place on June 28th. From 10 to noon at the State Museum. And the second panel discussion, The Art Journey, 30 Years of Art, is from 1 to 2, and that is at Heron on that same day as well, with the opening on the 27th, the night before.
That's right. And the panel discussions are free and open to the public, but you mm-hmm. do have to call to get a reservation because seating is limited.
Okay, very good. And they can call the State Museum for that?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And let me just add, I think Ed Sanders is a sort of perfect bridge because he was one of the founding members of 431. And his working life as an artist, he enrolled at Heron at age 35 and died at age 59. So,
wow, I didn't realize he had enrolled that late.
Yeah, he was an architect. He supported himself doing designs for suburban developments. Mm-hmm. But his real life was as an artist. And so you can see in the exhibition his development from the very first exhibition. There's a drawing of his children's drawing that he made at age 9. But right from the beginning, work of Heron right up to the very last works that he did for what proved to be his final posthumous exhibition.
Tell me about the process you went through in terms of choosing which works you've included in this exhibition. I mean, obviously, I'm sure there are some that stood out for you, but did you also talk to, you know, other artists, family, friends, as far as which ones they thought should be included?
Or? Well, when we first went down, Steve Mannheimer and mm-hmm. Steve Paddock, we all went and looked, and I took photographs, and we sent them out and said, which ones did you like? Which ones impressed you?
Yeah.
So we each of us put together a list, and we compared those and sort of went from there. And they were photographed generously by
Wilbur Montgomery.
Mm-hmm. So all of the things that were available, and I had to narrow it down to about 33. I was hoping to have 50, but mm-hmm. the works are so
big. They're big, though.
They're big and strong, and they just wouldn't fit.
And as big as the Heron Galleries are,
they wouldn't fit. So I mm-hmm. think it'll be an astonishing show. And ultimately, it was my choice, but obviously, there were some things I would have loved to have had that I couldn't find.
Mm-hmm.
And but nevertheless, it'll be a stunner, I think.
Now, the night of the opening, am I correct that it starts at the State Museum and then everyone will sort of proceed over, walk over to Heron?
Yes, it's a progressive.
A progressive, okay.
It starts at the State Museum at 6 o'clock and mm-hmm. goes until 7:30. And then we're going to invite everybody to head on over to Heron to see Ed Sanders' exhibition.
We hope it'll be a little bit like Mass Avenue, you know.
I was just thinking
up and
that.
Down the street and...
And I'm sure there'll be some beverages involved or what have you. So before I wrap this up, because I think this is such a really interesting exhibit in so many ways. I mean, I think it's really important to look back on where we've been and where we're going in terms of arts in this community. It's also great to have these two institutions working together. And so I want to ask you both, I mean, sort of as you've been working on this, what for you has been one of the most maybe surprising or inspiring or exciting things? And it may be, you know, a memory that you'd forgotten about that's sort of, you know, been brought back up to the surface, or something you've learned in the process of this. Mark, I'll start with you. What really stands out for you as far as something that's been important in this process for you?
Well, during my research, I've been in touch with many of the former members. Of the 70 or so original members over the 9 years, we're going to have just north of 40 represented in the show. So
wow,
we're going to have
really fantastic. I mean, yeah. that must have been just a task to try to get back in touch with all of them.
Well, a little bit of a challenge, but a good number of them have kept in touch with each other over the years. And the whole idea is we're going to have original work from the gallery days. But probably the most rewarding aspect of this has been their recollections of 431 and how important it was to them and how they valued that experience. And, you know, it was as if the, you know, the stars and the moons lined up for 431.
Yeah.
The space was available. The class came out of Heron. They got together. They worked together very, very well. It was a good cooperative. And the fact that it was around for 9 years says a lot about the movement itself. So it's probably those personal stories and the fact that it did make a difference in so many people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Brett, how about for you?
I think for me, the opportunity to see a body of work from the very beginning of an artist's career to the end,
mm-hmm.
and to see an artist who didn't just find a way to paint and then paint that way the rest of his life, but who continually evolved, absorbed things, changed, but never... It was never a sense of changing just for the sake of change. It was a personal growth. The art is so powerful and so personal that it was just a privilege to be involved. And also, I must say that his fellow 431 members and friends were so forthcoming and so eager to talk about Ed and their experience.
My understanding was that he really did, you know, use paintings to explore ideas and continue to sort of push it and develop it and go back to things and continue to...
Right. Well, and for example, in 1996, he spent the entire year drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Gigantic. You may have seen the show of... there was a show at the Harrison Center 10 years ago.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Of these giant drawings of crucifixions and Descent from the Cross and some other... things, all religious drawings, which were like out of the blue. He was raised a Catholic, and he did popes and so on, but then all of a sudden these great drawings. And then to morph into what one of his friends called the memory drawings, where clearly there are connections with his family and his childhood. It's been a great experience and a privilege.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming into Art of the Matter. It's been great to chat with you both, and I look forward to seeing both the shows. Mark, Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you. Travis.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with curators Mark Rushman and Brett Waller. The two exhibits, 431 Gallery Art and Impact and Ed Sanders, Life and Art, open on June 27th at Indiana State Museum and at the Heron School of Art and Design. For more information, visit indianamuseum.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Our calendar's so short, we don't have time to do anything clever, so we're just going to jump right into What'll We Do?
What do you want to do, Sharon?
Well, I have a couple of things. Don't forget, this weekend is the Woodruff Place Flea Market, Saturday 8
Yay.
To 5, and Sunday
Always
10
fun.
To 5. Things to eat, things to look at, and things to buy, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And also, next Wednesday, June 11th, rain or shine, it's Scavenge the Avenue, benefiting Indy Reads, 6 o'clock start at the Athenaeum. Scout clues up and down Mass Ave and support adult literacy, too. And there might or might not be time for a cold, frosty beverage. Find more at indiereads.org.
Sounds like a plan. Hey, something else you can do next week. The Face-to-Face, the Neo-Impressionist Portrait Show is opening at the IMA. This is really cool. It features work from Van Gogh and all sorts of other neo-impressionist painters. Some really interesting, almost bizarre, surrealistic stuff. I've seen a little bit of a preview of it. Can't wait to go check it out. And that opens next weekend at the IMA. Sharon, that is about all the time we have. So, you know, other than going to see The Fault in Our Stars.
That's right.
We'll just have to wait for next week until we get back to that calendar we call.
What'll we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Fine estate art and rugs has been a staple of the Broad Ripple Gallery scene since 2005. It has an enormous collection of handmade rugs and a selection of paintings that leans heavily in the direction of fine Hoosier painters. But if you've driven past recently, you may have noticed that owner Kirk Churchman has expanded his space to the south. And with his new Gallery 2, he has a whole new specialty. Kurt came in to explain to Sharon why he opened Gallery 2 and how he became an art dealer in the first place.
I'm guessing when you were at IU, you didn't say, I want to own a fine rug and art gallery.
It's true.
Was
that was not in the vision, near or far.
I don't know why I think that. I just think owning a gallery is probably not something people start out thinking they're going to do. So tell us about how you got on this path. Where were you going, and how did you get on this different route?
All right. So my family history has my grandfather having been a long time associated with the Indianapolis Art Center.
Oh.
And when it was the Art League and then, you know, come Art Center.
Sure.
So there's always kind of been an interest in art in, you know, whatever, in our peoples.
So you grew up around good art?
Yeah, I grew up around real art, and my parents loved antiques. So, you know, as a child, I was drugged to antique shows and what have you, you know, against my will. attended IU, yes, got a BA in Econ Soc, and then wound up for 10 years in the commodities trading business. Mm-hmm. I was a natural gas trader.
Were you here or did you leave town?
I was largely trading in Chicago, and I was in Traverse City, Michigan for a while, which has native gas production, go figure. And it's a little trading center. And my gig in gas in 98 wound down somewhat naturally. And when you're a trader, it's something of a burnout gig. So I'd been doing it for 10 years and elected to move back to Indianapolis in 98, which is my hometown, and without really a plan. I mean, I've always been very entrepreneurial, so I figured something would come around. Rugs are what started this mess, and they they were on embargo because of Iran. So we had an embargo with Iran up until the year, you know, after the Islamic Revolution, up until the year 2000, and they went off embargo. And shortly after that, I kind of caught wind of rugs just flooding the country.
Wow.
And there were opportunities to get them cheap. I had met a couple wholesalers or importers, and without really knowing having any idea what I was doing, started accumulating the stock of rugs and
How did you decide what to buy?
Well, it was an education experience for me. I mean, I bought books on rugs. I mean, I knew a little about rugs, not really very much, but I bought books on rugs and started reading, and I'm online. And of course, even back in whatever this started, 2001, 2002, the online resources were available, and then just looking at rugs. And, you know, you buy a rug and it might be a mistake and you learn or whatever and you go on. And so I was marketing to designers. I kind of cut my retail teeth down at Midland for a year or two. And the opportunity, I was in completely a different business at the time. It was a startup doing distribution, and it was kind of marginal. And so I had this opportunity to sell my share of that business and go retail. And by that point, you know, my retail had matured, and it almost went too well up to that point, which tricked me into thinking it was going to be a vast, bright future.
Thank goodness for those ups and downs in a life, because otherwise people would never take risks.
Right. Well, it's true. It's true. And so And so I wound up going retail in 2005 with the rugs and started the art shortly thereafter. I was at a location on North Carrollton, 65th and Carrollton, and then in 2007 moved to Ware Fine Estate, which is the name of the company that began all this, Ware Fine Estate Art and Rugs is located, 5914 North College, next to Binkley's at College and Kessler.
Great visibility. Great. I mean, thousands of cars.
Yeah,
daily.
You can't be 20,000 cars a day driving by. I don't ever feel like we do enough out on the sidewalk or making noise outside the shop, but we certainly try to do that. If you drive by, you know, Kessler and College on College, you'll see rugs drug outside the shop almost every day when we're open. And so that's when the art was fully installed, and the art component kind of was realized then. And then so thus, Fine Estate became sort of three businesses. We do custom framing. We have 1,200 handmade rugs, and we have historic Indiana artwork. So think T.C. Steele and William Forsythe and, you know, myriad others. We probably carry about 125 to 150 different historic Indiana artists.
And you have a new venture.
And we have a new venture. Right, right. And so adjacent to Fine Estate, 6 weeks ago, opened Gallery 2. And Gallery 2 continues the tradition of what Fine Estate does, Indiana art being loosely defined as Midwestern Impressionism, representational art, plein air paintings, you know, landscapes, still lifes, some portraiture. Gallery 2 continues that with living artists. And so we have about 10 artists we represent. We're going to add another one or two, I think, although we're pretty close to realizing the group. And actually, I'll tell you all their names. They're fantastic. Roy Boswell, Donna Short, Marianne Davis, Chris Newland, Wyatt LeGrand, Jerry Smith, David Seward, Todd Williams, who's from Northwest Arkansas, though always does Hoosier Salon stuff. And then we represent Austin Pittman, who does portraiture commissions.
Mm-hmm.
And all these folks are very well established, fantastic artists. They're saleable, which is good for Gallery too. They've got a long tradition of having been producing fine art and selling it. And again, it's all in the tradition of what we're doing next door at Fine Estate, but it's a slightly updated presentation as well.
It's a rather different dynamic dealing with living artists than dealing with the representatives of the estate of an artist long gone.
Yeah, or maybe not even representatives of estate as far as Fine Estate's concerned. A lot of those pieces were bought by someone's grandma or great-grandma.
Got it.
There's a T.C. Steele that we just sold one exactly like this. Grandma bought it. Man who owned it lived in Santa Barbara, California, inherited it within the last 2 years, irrelevant to him, although he appreciates what it is. Found me, and we marketed it and actually just recently sold it. But here they come in one by one occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you Google T.C. Steele or Randolph Coates or William Forsythe, you'll find me immediately. And so in that there is this diaspora of art spread all over the world, at least all over the country, and you never know where it's going to turn up, you know, the internet has made this very convenient.
Sure.
That model, though, is one of consignment or most of the stuff Fine Estate owns. Next door, it is totally a different business model. I'm representation for these guys, and that's more of a traditional gallery setup where they consign their pieces in, and we sell them, and then, you know, there's a split that takes place, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody's happy about that. They don't have to worry about marketing and visibility, and we're open 46 hours a week regularly, so anyone can stroll in any time and see a Chris Newland painting or a Roy Boswell painting, and mm-hmm. that's the cool thing for them.
Yeah, and it seems like there'd be some lovely interplay between the two sides, because maybe somebody comes in because they're following one of these younger living artists, and they stroll next door and they fall in love with somebody from the Hoosier Group or somebody from the Richmond Group.
Exactly. My vast hope with this whole venture is that we can cross-pollinate. And exactly as you described, you might have a follower of Donna Short. She comes in and like, oh, I didn't even know this historic art thing was a thing, or I need a rug, or we've got framing to do, and you appear to do framing. And so, and same with, you know, rug buyers, like, what's going on with the art when I can turn them onto this whole world of art? So, yes, we hope that by adding this other component, and it's been amazing because the artists have their own people. And so that's already played out where we had our grand opening and we've done one more opening, and the artists are there and their people are there, and they don't know anything about Fine Estate, yet all of a sudden instant exposure to Fine Estate.
Sounds like a very auspicious beginning.
Yeah.
Got to keep going, though.
Yes. Yeah, right. We must keep going.
So let's go back to rugs for a minute. Are the rugs that you have, are they all contemporary, or do you have antique rugs, or is it a mix?
Yeah, I think the name throws people off a little bit because it started as such, where they were estate pieces coming out of Iran largely, some mm-hmm. purchased here in the U.S., but just as wholesale goods. And then it morphed into quickly when I went retail, I had to add new product. A lot of people like old rugs, but they're always updated colors, updated designs, updated styles. There is a fashion to rugs. They're still traditional, generally. Most of the new product and all the old product in the shop is generally traditional. We do modern. The problem or the challenge with modern is that I'll never have the right modern rug and the right colors for the right space. And so a lot of that gets done as custom.
Oh,
but I
sure.
deal directly with Nepal, and it's a process whereby one has to, you know, sort of get a general design. It gets refined as a graphic, and then a sample is made, and colors are chosen and what have you, and then the rug goes to fabrication. Still handmade. They're amazing products.
So I happened to get an e-letter that you sent out a few weeks ago. I think it was for your grand opening or maybe before it. And you talked about on a buying trip, you fell in love with these little, they're like 2x3.
Yeah, I think I said it. Yeah.
What? How did you say it? It was very charming.
I was drunk with glee.
Yeah.
And bought 41 of them.
which brings me to the question, how do you, obviously anybody with a gallery, customers are going to see that the world of that gallery as filtered through the gallery owner and curator's taste. But how do you make sure you have a breadth of representation of rugs, of paintings, of framing materials for that matter? How do you not just fall in love with things and want to keep everything for yourself?
Well, hey, those are two separate questions.
Okay.
So on the first, you know, you got to follow your nose, I think. And I don't know that I'm prescient. Though I'm a native Hoosier, my taste may not necessarily dovetail with other folks who live in, you know, central Indiana or whatever. But at the end of the day, it is my venture. And, you know, who would know better than me how I want to present the whole thing? Not to sound arrogant on the topic. In terms of the rugs, you can't, as a rug dealer, you can't have all the rugs in all sizes. And
sure.
So you sort of have to pick your battles. I really don't have much capacity for more inventory, and we've established kind of what we sell, the different styles and designs and looks that we sell. And that works well. You know, we have customers for those, and that works well. I can always try to find stuff if someone's very specific, but because I have vast resources outside of what's just the shop. But rugs tend to be a tactile thing. You're in the shop, you see a rug, you try it at home, you buy it.
Which is why your business works in an internet age, which is why selling paintings or rugs works.
Yeah,
still.
You got to be live.
You have to see that painting. There's the highest resolution monitor is not going to make it pop the way seeing it in person will. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely helps seeing it in a space. That said, I mean, we just sold a fine estate painting last week to a person who had only seen it online. And then as a first, our painting of the moment, which we send out weekly, was a Robert Root piece. And I have a Robert Root collector who adores his work. And he's 80 or so and isn't so good with eBay, he told me. And I'm like,
aww.
Email? Yes, email. Not so good with email.
Bless
so I sent him the image and I told him the price. And he came back with a reasonable offer. And I'm like, now, you've seen the painting, right? And he's like, no, but it sounds right, so I'll buy it unseen.
Wow.
So occasionally it goes beyond even the tactile, but even the visual is not needed.
But there is a sense of trust.
There was a sense of trust, and certainly I want to be considered a trusted dealer, and so
yeah.
I hope he loves the painting.
So there's no way we can provide an art education to people in the short time we have left, but general rules, if somebody's been driving by, say, your shop for years and wants to go in there but is a little intimidated, give us some general rules to follow for people who want to buy art, who want to buy a beautiful rug. What should they be thinking about as they walk in?
Yeah, well, I certainly we try to have a very inviting vibe, and we are extremely low key. So we don't want anyone to feel intimidated. Usually, with rug shoppers, they need a little assistance because you know we've got these massive stacks of rugs, and you know we can turn them so and chatter about them as we show them you know what's available and the size that they want, or try to narrow down what they're looking for. But that usually takes a little bit of store interaction. Though happy to have rug buyers go on their own. You want to buy what you like. The rugs are traditionally contrast-inducing animals in a room. And so, you know, if you're into the rug and then the next step is taking it home and having a look at it in the space, if it works, and you'll know it works immediately or should, and they're, you know, can have a couple choices, but if it works, that's the rug.
That's it.
Yeah, that's it. And handmade rugs last forever. So, you know,
So you better love it.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, you better love it, right.
Choose the one you love.
Right, right. Or have some guest bedrooms or vacation home. With the art, it's a little more self-guided. People who come in to look at art tend to want to maybe discuss some things. We're always there for questions, but also sort of contemplate on their own each piece as they see it, what their experience is with that piece. So the art, again, you want to buy what you like. You want to buy what you're into. I find a lot of the times the stories of the individual artists are compelling. This is the crazy artist who was in Central State for a while, John Zwara, and his output is this, very unique to John Zwara. And you love the story and you love his output as you come to know it. And hey, all of a sudden you're a Zwara collector. Or this is the artist who worked largely in pastel and did tons of New York City cityscapes, even though he was from Indiana, Glenn Cooper Henshaw. So you love the sexy sort of ethereal look of Glenn Cooper Henshaw, and all of a sudden you discover this and are drawn in, and next thing you know, you're hooked on that kind of heroin.
Sharon Gamble with Kurt Churchman, owner of Fine Estate Art and Rugs, and Gallery 2. Find both at 5914 North College Avenue in Broad Ripple, as well as Fine EstateArt.com. Again, FineEstateArt.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at OwlStudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll chat with Storytelling Arts' Ellen Munns.
I'll find out about A Girl's Gift, a program that uses the arts and business to shape impressionable lives.
And I'll talk with comedian Scott Gregory. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.